From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Mayor Muriel Bowser of the District of Columbia, but joining us now is Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. Governor Northam, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Kojo and Tom. I hope you and your listeners are doing well.
So far, so good. Tom, before we get to Governor Northam specifically, it looks like the on-again, off-again program of Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland for I-270, the Beltway, and the American Legion Bridge might be on again. The Transportation Planning Board announcing that the plan will be considered next week at its July 21st meeting. How significant is this?
Well, it's really important because last month the Transportation Planning Board sidelined the Hogan $9 billion plan, and he was furious. He put out videos calling the opponents in Montgomery County a tiny, whiny minority. He's made a full court press to get membership on the regional board changed up in Frederick and other places, and he wants another vote. He had threatened at first, his administration did, that $6 billion of other roadway plans could be in danger if they didn't reverse this vote. Turns out it's really not that. It's closer to a billion. And even that, none of the plans in that project on that list or the governor has ever yet supported in the six-year plan. So the bottom line is Governor Hogan had his back against the wall. He's gotten some changes on the Transportation Board, and the vote is next Wednesday to see if it gets back on the active list of projects that could be done. It's one of his signature projects in his two terms as governor, and it also affects Northern Virginia.
Especially when we talk about the American Legion Bridge, so Virginia has an interest in this, Governor Northam. What is yours? How do you feel about it?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I work with Governor Hogan on the American Legion Bridge, and, you know, what a bottleneck that is, both for Maryland and Northern Virginia, and so we're moving forward with our, you know, side of the bridge, and hopefully that they'll be able to accomplish that as well. But, you know, we've put a lot of investment, Kojo, into transportation, a lot of good projects going on in Virginia, the Long Bridge coming across the Potomac River, which is going to allow us to bring more Amtrak service, also commercial rail. So a lot of good things are going on with transportation up in Northern Virginia.
But Tom Sherwood, is Montgomery County expected to end its objections?
No, Mark Elridge, the county executive, the elected leaders in Prince George's County, all say that the governor's plan is rooted in the 1950s, that he doesn't do enough to look ahead to what's going to be needed, what kind of rapid transit, bus lanes, maybe a metro line over the new portions of the American Legion Bridge. They say that it's not forward-looking enough, and it will just mean more lanes and more traffic.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. Governor Northam, in the first week of July, more than 43% of COVID-19 infections in our region are estimated to be the Delta variant. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. How concerned should Virginians be about the Delta variant?
Well, I would be very concerned, Kojo, and we're watching this closely. You know, our number of new cases every day in Virginia has ticked up. Today we had over 400. At one point we were less than 100. Our positivity rate is gone up. Over half of our new cases are Delta. And as long as there are vectors, in other words, as long as there are people out there that are unvaccinated, these viruses, this COVID-19 virus, will continue to survive. It will continue to mutate, and we won't be able to put it in the rearview mirror. So I would encourage all of your listeners, anybody that hasn't been vaccinated, 12 and above, we've got three safe and effective vaccines, J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer. I really encourage them to go out there, roll their sleeve up, and get a shot.
We're also seeing a slow rise of COVID-19 cases in the region, perhaps because of the July 4th holiday weekend. Do you foresee adding any additional COVID-19 restrictions?
Well, we have followed the CDC guidelines all along. We'll continue to do that every day. Kojo, I get up and look at the numbers. And right now, we're in a good place. We're certainly in a much better place than we were over a year ago. 73% of adults in Virginia have had at least one or both shots. We have 63% of adults who are completely vaccinated. So, you know, we're in a good place. But again, if these folks that are either on the fence or have, you know, chosen not to get a vaccine, I would strongly encourage them to do so.
Tom Sherwood.
Governor, one thing you do have some control over is the unemployment system. Every state, D.C. included in Virginia, has had trouble meeting the crush of demands for unemployment insurance payments. There was a demonstration in Richmond, I believe, outside the legislature just this very week or yesterday. What can you tell people who have not gotten unemployment money for months? Is there any hope in the future on what's happening with unemployment?
Yeah, Tom, we are working on this diligently. You know, we had over 1.7 Virginians. We have a total of 8.5 million Virginians. Over 1.7 applied for unemployment. And overall, we've done a good job getting benefits to those folks, though there are some that are appealing, and we have hired more individuals to look at the appeal process, what we call adjudicators. We also are offering incentives to businesses and new employees. We have training and retraining programs. We promoted the G3 program, which allows individuals to go to our community colleges without incurring any debt. So these unemployment benefits will stop as of September 6th, the federal part of it. And so, you know, we are helping folks in Virginia to get back into the workforce. And those that are unable to get back into the workforce, we're getting everything, doing everything that we can to make sure that they receive their benefits.
In case you're just joining. Go ahead, Tom.
I would say if you'll let me, I will go to one of the big issues in Virginia that's getting some national attention.
Allow me to interrupt for a second because I do have a vaccination question before we move on for the governor coming from Robert in Alexandria, Virginia. Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo, and thank you, Governor Northam. I've appreciated having an actual medical doctor lead us through the pandemic and through the recovery. Governor Northam, is your administration open to any sort of vaccine verification app, sometimes called a vaccine passport, for Virginia? Mass recommendations remain in effect for those who are unvaccinated, but this is currently an honor system. Virginia was the first state to roll out its COVID-wise exposure notification app. Can we expect something similar for vaccines?
Robert, we certainly have a lot of options on the table. We have put so much emphasis, and we've had so many good people, volunteers, et cetera, with our vaccination clinics, and overall they have done well. I've talked before. We can talk about sticks versus carrots. I'm a carrot person. I really encourage people to get out there and do the right thing for themselves, for their families, for their neighbors, et cetera. So we have the vaccines available in the Commonwealth of Virginia. As I said earlier, three safe and effective vaccines. So I really encourage everybody to get out there and do the right thing and take a shot.
Will students or teachers at K-12 schools be required to receive the vaccine?
Well, they're not. It's not a mandate, Kojo. But as folks know in Virginia, those that are age 12 and above have been approved by the FDA to receive the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine. And we should hear in the next month, a month and a half, from the FDA regarding children younger than 12. And we're certainly encouraging them to take advantage of that. There also have been a lot of questions about wearing masks in schools. We have an executive order that people will continue to wear masks in our K-12 systems through July the 25th. We will have guidelines coming out in the next couple of days for those that have been vaccinated. So I would say stay tuned, and we're going to give folks in the school districts more guidance in the days to come.
Our guest is Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. Tom Sherwood.
Governor, critical race theory. Loudoun County has been a ground zero of conservative efforts to raise that as a national issue. It's being raised across the country by conservatives. What can you tell the people in Virginia about this this battle over critical race theory? Is it a real battle? Is it a political battle? What's happening in the state of Virginia with critical race theory?
Well, Tom, I would say that it's a political battle, unfortunately. But just to put things in perspective, critical race theory, it's a graduate-level academic subject that is not a part of our K through 12 curriculum in Virginia. I'll repeat that. It is not a part of our K through 12 curriculum. And frankly, Tom, I think it's a dog whistle, and it's being used by folks who want to scare people in an election year. And what I'm interested in, what our administration is interested in, is teaching an accurate version of our history. And we've made a lot of progress on that. We have a lot of history in Virginia. We were the birthplace of the American experiment, but we were also the capital of the Confederacy. So students deserve to learn the truth about where we've been so we can build a better future and so that we can understand each other's cultures and all be in this together.
Let's see if that answers Stephanie in Arlington's question. Stephanie, does it?
It really does. Hi, Governor Northam. I'm a teacher in Fairfax County, and I am concerned about how strong the voices are who are confronting school boards. And I really did want to hear your voice in what's going on so that we feel supported. But I'm wondering if you could also talk about exactly what the VDOE is doing right now to revise curriculum.
Yes, Stephanie, thanks for all you do. I'm a big fan of our teachers, and as you know, you're just so important for workforce development, and it's one of the reasons Virginia was just named the number one state in which to do business. So we're working with the Department of Education, looking at the curriculum, making sure, Stephanie, that what we teach our students regarding history is adequate, and also accurate. And I don't think that's been the case. And so we want folks to learn about each other's cultures, again, as I just said, so that we know where we've been so that we can build a better future.
Thank you for your call, Stephanie. I know this is the Politics Hour, so I'm fully expecting that Tom Sherwood has a few questions for you about the upcoming elections.
Oh, good. I like that green light for me. Okay, good. Well, Governor, I have a couple, so if you would just kind of give me a summary. But today, the Democratic candidate for governor, Terry McAuliffe, reported having $9 million on hand. And he's far and away above all the other candidates. And Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, is going to maybe use his own fortune to run. But there have been some issues. I've always enjoyed the Virginia Bar Association debate, which has been held ever since 1985. And I know you're the Democrat and you support McAuliffe, but what is the political reason to avoid appearing in the debate before the Virginia Bar Association? Mr. Youngkin has declined, saying that he doesn't essentially trust Judy Woodruff of public television to be the moderator.
Well, I don't think Mr. Youngkin wants to answer the questions that Virginians need to hear answers for. And, you know, he's been talking this past week about Virginia's, that I and Governor McAuliffe have run the state into a ditch. Well, we were just named the number one state in this great country of ours in which to do business. So Mr. Youngkin is either out of touch with reality or he's being untruthful. And, you know, we just had a president, Tom, that was untruthful to Americans for 4 years. And we do not need a governor that's going to be untruthful. And he needs to come forward. He needs to answer questions. And what a great debate that is that the Bar Association has. And for him to duck out of that, that's the beginning of the campaign season, historically. It's a very fair debate. Judy Woodruff, she was the moderator when Mr. Gillespie and I debated. There were no complaints at all. So this excuse that he's coming up with to not be in a debate, I just think is very cowardly, and I hope he changes his ways, especially if he wants to be governor of this great Commonwealth.
Well, we should mention that what Governor Northam characterized as the excuse is that Youngkin said that because Judy Woodruff once gave a contribution to a Bill and Hillary Clinton Foundation for assistance in Haiti, that means that he will not participate in the debate. But go ahead, Tom Sherwood.
Well, just to be clear on that point, Kojo, that was a fundraising event that was promoted by the Clintons, former
and
President
George W. Bush.
George Bush and President Obama, so it wasn't a partisan thing. The other big issue is abortion. And again, Mr. Youngkin is invited on this program. I'm sure we'll talk to him if he'll accept our invitation. But there's also the issue of him being caught on a videotape saying he couldn't discuss his plans to oppose Planned Parenthood or any abortions in the state because it would hurt him in suburban Virginia with women in the state. He hasn't said too much about that since the video surfaced. Again, is abortion an issue in this campaign?
Well,
and again,
you know,
you're a Democrat.
Obviously, you know, women and their providers should be in charge of their reproductive health care. And we as men especially don't need to be telling women what they should and shouldn't be doing with their bodies. But back to Mr. Youngkin, you can't have it both ways. You know, he's got to be straight up with the Virginians. They expect someone who's authentic, someone who tells the truth, and that's what they're going to be looking for. That's who they're going to be voting for come November. And, you know, I'm obviously biased, but I certainly believe, and if you look at our economy in Virginia, good things happen in Virginia when we elect Democrats, and this has been a great year for Virginia.
Here is Jeff in Springfield, Virginia. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Governor, and I hope your family is healthy and well. And you've done a great job guiding the state through this pandemic. My question is, last year, because of the budget shortfall, you had to do a budget rescission on a line item that would have provided a couple million dollars, I believe, in assistance to community organizations, including churches and synagogues that have had to increase their security detail and put in cameras and other things that are very costly because of the attacks on religious institutions. I'm wondering, I believe there's going to be a bill filed in the special session, the second special session, to restore those funds for community organizations, including religious organizations. And if it gets to your desk, will you sign it?
Absolutely, Jeff, and thank you so much for that question. And we want people to feel safe and secure in Virginia, especially in places of worship. And so we have a couple options. The legislature will be coming back to Richmond on August the 2nd. We'll be dealing with $4.3 billion, with a B, dollars of rescue plan money. And then we'll also go into session. I will provide an outgoing budget. Right now we have a surplus in Virginia because our economy has been doing so well of $2.6 billion. So whether it's in this special session or whether it's in the 2022 general session, it will certainly be included because we feel very strongly that, again, Virginians need to feel safe and secure.
Well, this week you outlined your plan to put $350 million towards economic revitalization. Given the secure state of Virginia's economy, why does it need this boost, and why did you decide that this was the best way to use some of the federal funding Virginia has received?
That's a great question, and, you know, today I just want to let everybody know that I'm going to be making an announcement in about a half an hour. You all are going to be the first to hear it. We're proposing, and we have agreement from the money committees in both the House and the Senate, $700 million to complete expansion of broadband in Virginia. We see broadband in 2021 as electrification was in the early 1900s. It is a necessity. We learned this even more so during COVID-19, whether it be virtual learning, telehealth, business opportunities, or really just quality of life. So I'm going to make that announcement in about a half an hour. But also, COVID, to your question, Kojo, Rebuild Virginia has been very successful to help small businesses get back on their feet. So just a few days ago, we proposed using $350 million of the rescue plan money to support Rebuild Virginia, also to support tourism in Virginia. So again, we know that these things are important, especially the hospitality industries have been hit really hard during COVID-19. So we want to do everything that we can to get these folks back on their feet.
Tom Sherwood.
I don't want to pass over what the governor just said, that the state just announced a $2.6 billion surplus, and there's $4.2 billion in federal funds. that the legislature can address on that August the 2nd meeting. Governor, you can't run for re-election. But compared to last year, when you were looking at what you would have to cut and what you were going to have to do, the state, like many jurisdictions, is flush with money. You've got to present a two-year budget to the legislature in December. But I want to ask two things. One, is it hard to decide how to spend all that money? And two, what are you going to do when you're out of office in January?
Well, I appreciate the questions, Tom. And we are working with the money leaders in both the House and the Senate on how we distribute the rescue money, as you said, $4.3 billion. And certainly small businesses. I already mentioned broadband, financial aid for our higher education in Virginia, for our colleges and universities. Mental health is very important. There have been a lot of people that were affected by COVID-19 and then unemployment. So those are some areas that we'll be focused on, on the August 2nd special session. In our outgoing budget, I've always been an advocate for education. I really believe it's the foundation of our economy. And so we'll be putting money into our G3 program to make sure that people can go to our community colleges without incurring any debt. Early education is something that we put a lot of emphasis on. So there are a lot of priorities that we have. And then regarding me, Tom, my term ends, as you all know, in January. It's been a tremendous privilege to serve this Commonwealth. And I know I'm going to leave Virginia in a better place than when I started. As you said, a surplus of $2.6 billion. AAA bond rating. We've been able to give our teachers raises. Great legislation. One of my proudest days was when I signed the piece of legislation to end the death penalty in Virginia. We've done a lot of voting rights in Virginia. So just really good things are happening. And we believe overall that, we've proven in Virginia that when you treat people right, it's not just the right thing to do, but it's also good for business and good for our economy. And
what
I'm trained as a
you?
Physician, a child neurologist, and I plan to go back to Hampton Roads and take care of sick children and their families, something that, I look forward to doing.
Thank you.
Well, we remember in 2019 the scandal that engulfed you having to do with the race issue and the blackface situation. But however, since then, during your term, the New York Times recently had a piece back in June saying that you have turned out to be the most progressive governor on racial issues in Virginia's history. But I have a related question from Barbara, who tweets, please ask the governor what he thinks of the progress made at VMI with regard to race issues, and also please address the recent issues regarding sexual harassment.
Yes, Barbara, I appreciate the question, and this is, one of the reasons that we ordered the investigation. I thought some of the reports were very, very disturbing, and I expect Virginians did as well. So VMI is addressing the racial issues, also addressing the sexual issues, especially abuse of women. And they have a lot of work to do. They realize that. The board is focused on improving these situations. But whether it be VMI or any other college or university in Virginia, we want to embrace and promote diversity. We want to embrace inclusivity and make sure that all of our students, staff, faculty, et cetera, are welcome and feel comfortable on our college campuses. So that's what the Democratic Party will pursue, and VMI is certainly one of those colleges.
We only have about a minute left, but possession of small amounts of recreational marijuana in Virginia is now legal in Virginia. So I'll have Janet in McLean, Virginia, get the last question. Janet, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Governor Northam.
Only have about 30 seconds left, Janet.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. It's good to hear you, Janet.
What are your plans? Hello, good to hear from you. What are your plans to free those with marijuana convictions now that marijuana has been legalized? And why haven't you freed those with marijuana convictions yet? What is your plan to ensure equity, reparations, and reversal of harm when it comes to the new market?
You got about 25 seconds.
Yes, Janet, thank you so much for that. And I agree with your question, and we are sealing records. Also, some would refer to that as expungement, but so many people's lives have been ruined because of disparate
And so you're going to change that. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Ralph Northam is the governor of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us. Next up, Muriel Bauer, District of Columbia Mayor. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. Tom Sherwood is still with us. He's our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Joining us is Muriel Bowser, the mayor of the District of Columbia. Mayor Bowser, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Kojo. Thank you for having me.
Tom Sherwood, before we get into the district specifically, there's a Metro committee that has decided that people who commit crimes of weapon and sex crimes on the Metro system should be banned. Of course, the suspension policy may be a little hard to enact because people can, unless they're recognized by someone, get away with it. But what's going on here?
Well, first of all, I'm surprised that there's not something in the rules already that you could ban nuisance or serious violators of law riders. But the committee has suggested that the board approve a plan that if you have a first offense of a violation in the Metro system, you get a 14-day suspension. A second offense would be 30 days. And a third offense within a 12-month period would be a one-year suspension. The problem is, as you just suggested, how do you enforce it? If you're a nuisance at the Metro Center and then you want to get on at Fort Totten or somewhere else, I mean, who's going to know that you're a nuisance at Metro Center? So it sounds like it would be difficult, but I think it's part of the Metro's effort to bring riders back to the rail system to say, look, we are working hard to make the trains run on time. We want it to be safe, secure, and efficient. And I think that's what this is.
What do you think about it, Mayor Bowser?
I only heard the headline, Kojo, and so I would want to learn a little bit more about it. But obviously, we don't want people committing violent crimes on the Metro. We want to make sure everybody has due process, and we want to continue to have one of the safest, cleanest systems anywhere in the world.
We'll have to see how this rolls out. Mayor Bowser, D.C.'s public health emergency is set to expire July 25th, and you do not plan on extending it. What will change for the district for district residents once the emergency ends?
Well, first, Kojo, it was D.C. residents and businesses who made tremendous sacrifices to get us where we are with COVID-19 well under control in our city, with city government open, with all restrictions related to COVID in terms of gatherings and business operations lifted. So we don't need to operate in the state of a public health emergency at this time. And for D.C. residents, what we continue to ask them to do is get back to life, get vaccinated if they haven't been vaccinated, encourage their family and friends and coworkers to get vaccinated if they haven't been vaccinated, so that we can keep our city on the path of a comeback.
Tom Sherwood.
Thank you for being here, Mayor. Two questions. One about this. There are some D.C. You've welcomed all the D.C. workers back to their offices. There are some workers who've been in touch with me who are saying that there are some workers who think they should still be able to work from home, that they can still be effective. I want to know what you think about that. And then also the council has passed legislation or is passing legislation to stretch out the possibility of evictions so there won't be a massive wave of evictions for people who are behind in their rent. And I know you have Stay DC, which is a program to help pay it. But do you agree with the council legislation that's making its way to your desk?
Well, first, let me just talk about how city government is operating. And everyone knows that we're a local government. We provide local services. People come to the government for everything from driver's licenses to public health benefits to birth certificates to constituent services related to sidewalks and trees. So the work that we do, by and large, is in-person work with residents of the district. Throughout this pandemic, Tom, 40% of D.C. residents reported to work in person, and we're so grateful for everything that they did, from picking up the trash to policing the streets, for all of our comms officials who were working with members of the press to get all the public information out, our HCMON, D.C. health workers, all reporting in person. And gradually, as all of our health metrics improved, our employees started reporting back to the office. And this week, all of our agencies are reporting to the office. And some employees are requesting some days to continue to work at home, and their managers are considering those requests.
How about the D.C. Council emergency legislation for a phased ending to eviction and utility cutoffs? Council Chairman Phil Mendelson described it as a soft lining. Without it, all evictions would have been allowed to resume 60 days after the end of this public health emergency. What do you think about the legislation?
I think that the council is taking the right steps, and I think it's important that all of your listeners know we have enough federal dollars to cover the back rent and utilities for people who have been impacted by COVID. So they need to sign up for Stay DC so that they can have access to those dollars. And they are generous. Stay DC is paying 12 months of back rent, 3 months looking forward. So for people who have been impacted by COVID, they need to start the process so that they can get access to those dollars.
It's my understanding, though, that your office has some concerns about the utility disconnection part of the plan. What's that all about?
I would actually have to look at all of the details of the plan. We want to make sure, and then everything I just said about, when I say the plan, I mean the council's plan.
Sure.
Everything I just said about rent applies to utilities as well. For the utilities, I think the restrictions are a little bit more income limited. So we want to make sure that people are signing up, providing their information so we can get relief out to them.
Empower DC, a local organizing group that many of us are familiar with, it's focused on racial, economic, and environmental justice, tweeted this question: how many DC residents currently need deeply affordable housing, and with your strategy, how many years will it take to meet that need?
If they're asking about our $400 million commitment to affordable housing and our plan to get 36,000 new units by 2025, it's probably the most aggressive local commitment to affordable housing that you're going to find anywhere in the U.S. And so we not only focus on how we're creating housing, but also how we're helping D.C. residents afford more housing through our jobs program, through our focus on increased wages in our city. And I think that we are doing everything possible to make sure that both strategies and creating more affordable housing and helping D.C. residents increase their wages means that more people will be able to afford to live in D.C.
Tom Sherwood.
Mayor, two political questions. I know you're expecting one of them, but I want to first ask you, I get a lot of calls from people, some repeatedly, that the city is not acting on its archives, that there isn't an archives director, that important material from these last historic year will be lost, that the archives needs to be shaped up with a building and with a director. Is there anything you can tell folks about whether there'll be a new archives director appointed or not? Before I get to the politics questions.
Well, there certainly will be a new person appointed. We are recruiting for that position. And when we have the right person, appointment will be made. And I have to admit some frustration as well that we haven't been able to advance more quickly with the building. We've had a couple of different iterations of where the location should be. We're pleased that we will be able to move forward at UDC, and that also required some, you know, puts and takes to make sure that we get that properly funded.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you if you're going to run for a third term. As you know, I ask you every time I see you. What I will ask you, though, should you make that announcement to run, as I expect you will fairly decently, will you run as a ranked, would you use public funding system, or would you do a traditional campaign in terms of collecting money for your campaign? Public funding or traditional?
Just say, Tom, I am just grateful that so many people are excited about a third Bowser administration. I'm certainly excited about what that could mean in terms of getting our projects done. We were just at St. Elizabeth yesterday, and we had a series of, of announcements in Ward 8. We were talking about Whitman Walker coming, new townhomes being built. I was in the shadow of the sports and entertainment complex, a new parking facility, a new hospital, all in our sights. When I became mayor, none of those projects were, you know, even committed to, less more than in the ground and people enjoying them, people living there, people working there, and
Mayor.
Very soon, people having access to health care there. So we still have a lot to do. I'm excited about it. Your question was about how we'll run the campaign. I'm learning about public financing. You know, this would make my sixth campaign. I will do what's best to make sure we have what we need to get our message out to the people.
Well, let's continue talking.
Real quickly, Coach O. Ranked choice voting.
That's what I was going to ask about. Okay. At-large Councilmember Christina Henderson introduced a ranked choice voting bill this week. A lot of people think ranked choice voting would be especially helpful in crowded at-large elections. The election that Henderson was in had 23 candidates competing for 2 seats. And I guess Tom wants to know, as I do, where do you stand on ranked choice voting?
And Henderson only got 15% of the vote.
I got to tell you, one thing I appreciate about elections is knowing who won. and not having a election result for 2 weeks, I find pretty unsatisfying. So I will look forward to the debate and how the council discusses the issue. And I don't anticipate weighing in now. And I certainly hope they don't want to change the way elections happen before the next one.
Tom Sherwin?
Well, what about in terms of ranked choice voting, other than New York? People said it worked very well, except it took a couple of weeks to figure out who won. Is there any objection other than that? Christina Henderson, the at-large candidate who won and then put in this bill, she only won with 15% of the vote. Robert White, who was running for re-election, only got 25% of the vote. Now, there were 24 people in the race. But it just seems to me that it would be good to have a person get elected with more than a few percentages of the vote, that you have to get at least 50% in order to be in office.
Well, then you're making an argument for a runoff election, which has never really, you know, that's been long discussed, and nobody has ever really accepted that as a way to do the election in the district. And then I hear these arguments that it helps women, it helps minorities. Well, in New York, you know, a man won, and he won handily. He won handily from the first ballot count, and I think he won all but one of the boroughs. And after all of the ranked choices were considered. So, like I said, Tom, I'm not going to tell you today that this is where I'll land on it, but I will actively listen and then participate in the council's discussion of it. I think what's critically important is that we attract great people to run for offices, and that voters can easily participate and understand the process, and that it is clear. Can you imagine? I just can't imagine in this town. I know anytime the results come out after 11 o'clock, people start getting antsy. I'm waiting 2 weeks for a result.
It won't affect you. If you in your reelection for the this won't go into effect of 2024, so you have a lot of time to think about it.
Yeah, what's the level above?
I don't know when the hearing process will start or the voting will start, but I think we should take it very seriously about how we change how people elect their leaders.
Well, whatever's the word for antsier than antsy, that's what we'll be looking at. Here's Zach in Petworth. Zach, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo, and good afternoon, Mayor Bowser. So with the collapse of a five-story building earlier this month at 916 Kennedy Street Northwest, as well as a fire that caused the death of two people, including a child back in 2019 on the 700 block of Kennedy Street, what more do you think DCRA should do long term to prevent these tragedies from continuing to occur? And secondly, your proposed fiscal year 22 budget does not call for funding the recently authorized Department of Buildings. When do you expect to get that agency off the ground once the DC Council provides funding for it this budget cycle?
Well, that won't be my priority, I can tell you that. I think creating two DCRAs doesn't make either one of them more efficient or effective. And I want to clarify for you, I'm not sure, and certainly we were all very disturbed by the construction incident in the 900 block of Kennedy Street, but it wasn't a building collapsing. It was a partially constructed framing on a construction project happening, and the workers there were injured. So it's something that we should all be concerned about. What we are waiting on is where that construction was in its process and making sure that the inspections matched up to the stage of construction that was happening. So at this point, I can't tell you that there was something that the agency missed or that there was something that the construction team did wrong in the midst of a storm that also came through. I said a lot of words to say that was probably the perfect storm of a partially built frame coming down. But we need to wait to see what the inspection says.
I should mention that Zach is particularly interested because he's an ANC commissioner in 4D. Mayor Bowser, we're now hearing more and more about the Delta variant. How concerned should we be about it? And do D.C. officials know exactly how prevalent it is in the district?
We are able to do, and Dr. Nesbitt is the right person to talk about how our public health officials approach what they call sequencing the testing samples that we get so that we can detect the prevalence of each variant. And we, of course, are concerned about how this virus can mutate. Viruses mutate, so this is not unexpected. And you can see when you look in areas of the country and the world where there is less vaccination, this variant is fast spreading. So our message to D.C. residents is straightforward. Get vaccinated. That is our best protection against the variant. And I also want to be clear about this. If we do have some concern that warrants a change in our posture, we're going to communicate that aggressively. But that is not what where we feel we are.
There are will there be a mask requirement for students and teachers in D.C. public schools come fall?
Will there be, I'm sorry?
A mask requirement for students and teachers in D.C. public schools this fall.
Yes, that is our expectation, especially since children under 12 still aren't able to be vaccinated.
Tom Sherwood.
Mayor, let's talk about crime. The city has passed 100 homicides, first time of this quickly in a year since 2003. You were at the White House with President Biden and other leaders talking about what to do. There are federal programs. You've announced your own programs for job opportunities and safety and police work. And you said on public broadcasting in an interview after that meeting at the White House that you've seen crime and homicide rates go up and you've seen them go down. Are we just in a new cycle of going up no matter what happens, or are we experiencing something new?
Well, I think for sure what I can say we're experiencing is just a prevalence of guns in our city. More people carrying guns and more people willing to use those guns. Now, others will say we've always had illegal guns on our street, and that's not different. But I think if you talk to some of the police officials, they feel a difference in just the saturation of guns. And even among people who are wayward and not going the right way, they're not all gun carriers, but we're seeing more and more saturation of gun carriers in our city. And when that happens, you're going to have more shooting and, unfortunately, more homicide. You're right to say that we have a big budget proposal in front of the council that deals with alternatives to policing in very big ways, from funding cash assistance programs, housing programs for returning citizens, to hiring more people in our public safety programs and to DPW jobs. In our Pathways program, which is really working to train people to be ready for work. So we have a huge amount of dollars to invest in people who want a different path. And so we look forward to getting many of those programs operational, and the council actually approved pre-funded, if you will, so that some of those programs could start this summer.
Let's see if that answers the question of Jeanette in Ward 5. Jeanette, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Hello, Mayor Bowser. With your meeting with the President Biden regarding gun violence prevention and the strategies, what are your expectations from the meeting?
Well, I will say one of my key messages was that all of our law enforcement partners have to be operating at 100% and performing more in-person activities. I will say that COVID has impacted service provision. And if you can imagine anything, from drop-in centers that were closed to rec centers that were closed. But some things you may not think about are court trials have been delayed. Supervision agency, CSOSA, and our child, the court social services that supervises children who are youth involved, have not been operating in person. So one of my big messages and requests, and I'm happy to say that I've gotten follow-up on it already, is to get those agencies going. The United States attorneys not seating grand juries to move on indictments. All of the parts of our criminal justice system have to be working, just like we're focused on helping people get in jobs programs and have alternatives to a life of crime. When there are people who need touches with the criminal justice system, it has to work, and it has to work quickly.
Tom Sherwood, we have 1 minute left. Your turn.
Whoa. Well, I will ask you then about policing. You know, some people say the reforms that you and the council have supported have helped weed out bad police officers, but also discouraged good officers who feel like they've been made the victims or the perpetrators of bad policing throughout the city and the nation. What do you say to the officers who say they're trying to do a good job and while neighborhoods want more police officers, but they just want better police officers?
In 30 seconds or less, Madam Mayor.
Well, I say thank you to our officers. I think anybody who thinks they haven't had a tough year wouldn't, you know, be being completely honest with themselves. And the vast majority of our officers want to do the right thing. They want to support the city and they want to go home safely to their families. So Chief Conte and I and the whole of government is committed to making sure we have fair policing and safe neighborhoods. And that's
Mayor Muriel Bowser, thank you so much for joining us. The Politics Hour is produced by Sydney Grant, and our managing producer this week is Martin Ostermer, who somehow managed to stop watching the Tour de France just long enough to help with the show. Our phone screener is the remarkable Bruce Bromer. On behalf of Tom Sherwood and yours truly, thank you for listening and stay safe. I'm Kojo Namdi.